There are new books being added to the RNIB Talking Books Library every day. Now, you may have seen the TV show presented by Jeremy Paxman, Britain's Great War, shown on BBC One with audio description. Well, the book that accompanies that show is now available from RNIB Talking Books.
The family never learned precisely what killed Uncle Charlie. Was he machine-gunned to death? Was he one of the thousands who'd been weakened by the dysentery and typhoid that quickly spread among the men, pinned down in disgusting conditions in the gullies below the enemy machine guns for days on end? The memory of some others who died there, bakers' sons from the Orkneys, gardeners and footmen from the royal estate at Sandringham, the almost 500 men of the Dublin Fusiliers, or the son of the Vicar of Deal who won the Victoria Cross for repeatedly wading ashore under fire to rescue wounded men from the beaches, has been kept more conscientiously alive. The deaths of over 11,000 Australian and New Zealand soldiers at Gallipoli are venerated as a sacred part of their nation's histories.
A clip of Jeremy Paxman reading the introduction to Great Britain's Great War, with the rest of the text being read by Roy McMillan. Jeremy Paxman told me why he decided to write the book.
Well, what had interested me for quite a long time is not so much the stories of the battles, I'm not a military historian, but the story of what this extraordinary conflict did to our country. I think that it changed more or less everything. I think if you were a Victorian time traveller and had come back in 1914, you would understand exactly how the country worked. But if you came back 10 years later in 1924, after the war, you wouldn't have a clue.
Now, what actually came first? Was it the book or the TV show?
I wrote the synopsis for the book, and then I gave that to the television producers and to the publishers. And I sort of worked on the two simultaneously, really. I suppose the book came a bit first, except for some bits towards the end, when frankly, I fell rather behind.
Because I noticed the book's a lot more personal to you than the TV show was.
Is it?
Well, on a TV show, we didn't hear about your family, but that's how the actual book starts.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think there's any... This is my great-uncle Charlie, you mean? Who signed up in that rush of volunteers in the autumn of 1914. Possibly the spring of 1915. I think it was 1914. He was dead by August 1915. He was a private in the Royal Army Medical Corps. I don't suggest that there's anything unusual about that experience. I think every family had very often something very, very similar. I mean, there were something like 16,000 villages in England and Wales in 1918, and there were 40 of them to which all the men who had volunteered or been conscripted to serve returned at the end of the war. So this was a massive, massive casualty level. And I don't suggest there's anything unusual about the experience of my great-uncle Charlie beyond the fact that his photograph had hung on the wall when I was growing up. And I'm fascinated by the fact that this is an event which has passed now from family history, really, to the realms of pure history. And frankly, a history that's very poorly understood.
I think my family was lucky because there's a tradition of shipbuilding in the family, which was a huge essential trade at the time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, shipbuilding, various foundries, the munitions factories, the mines, all of these had groups of men who were exempt from military service. Although when things got really tough in the spring of 1918, very large numbers of these men who were in what were called reserved occupations said, I know I'm exempt from military service, but I want to serve. There were lots of people who tried it on, of course. Lots of people who thought, for example, there were tripe dressers in the northwest of England who appeared saying it's an essential trade. Women can't do this. I must therefore be exempt from military service. There was even a bloke in Leeds who tried to claim that he shouldn't do his military service now and until he completed his course of hair restoration.
Now, going back to the start of the war, and it's something that's been debated on TV at the moment, but was it a necessary war?
Well, I don't know. All wars are, in a sense, unnecessary, aren't they? Because they are the resolving of disputes by means other than the sensible way of resolving disputes, which is to argue things out and come to an agreement. So was it necessary? I think it was inevitable. I think that at some point, I know there are people now saying that it was a war we didn't need to get into, but I think at some point there would necessarily have come a conflict with Germany and probably the rest of Europe, as was to happen again with the Second World War. There was something about German militarism, German ambitions, German imperial dreams, I think. They felt, you know, hard done by comparison with Britain and France. I think sooner or later there was bound to be a conflict, yes.
What surprised me, the fact that there were protests for peace before war broke out, very much like the protests we had before the Iraq War.
Yes, there were. Bertrand Russell, for example, who was a prominent pacifist at the time, Bertrand Russell felt that he had suddenly lost contact with his country when he saw, in those early days in August 1914, he saw people running around, apparently enthusiastic about war. I slightly dispute that. I'm not sure they were enthusiastic about war so much as enthusiastic about something that was completely unknown to them. Nobody, of course, appreciated what the cost would be. And Bertrand Russell wandering around London was just astonished and appalled by what he saw, and felt that he just didn't understand Britain any longer. But there were pacifists right from the start, yes.
You discussed the pacifists and also the conscientious objectors in the TV show. Now, why did you call them cranks?
I didn't call the conscientious objectors cranks. I said it has always seemed to me that the extreme conscientious objectors were cranks. That's not saying that all conscientious objectors were cranks. I'm saying, or what I said when I was asked by the producer, what do you really think of these people? And I said, well, I rather admire those who refuse to join in something because everyone else was doing it. I admire them for that. But the extreme ones who refused to have anything to do with the war strike me as being so eccentric that the word crank is merited. There were, for example, many Quakers who went and served in something called the Friends Ambulance Unit and were largely admired by soldiers because although they didn't fight, they were extremely brave in rescuing casualties and treating them. So, you know, and there were many other conscientious objectors who did vital war work, whether it was working in factories or working on the land. So, you know, there were many other ways of coming to the aid of a country in a situation, of course, it shouldn't have been in, perhaps. But just to refuse to do anything does strike me as an eccentric position.
Now, you looked at the movie The Battle of the Somme and talk about how it was a gamble that paid off, showing the public real images of the horror of war, galvanising the public behind the war effort. Now, why do you think subsequent images of war, say from the war in Vietnam, had the opposite effect?
I think there are a number of differences, of course. You're talking about images of the Vietnam War, which helped consolidate a lot of anti-war opinion. Now, there was an anti-war opinion before much of that was seen. It was not a popular war, even from the start. It was very easily got into, the Vietnam War, and was very difficult to get out of. But people were experiencing those images of the war in their own homes, of course. They were seeing them via television, whereas cinema was a collective experience. This was silent cinema, of course, watched in picture houses. Vast numbers of people, huge numbers of people, for the first 3 or 4 weeks of the screening of this film. People had never seen anything like this before, and they experienced it collectively. And I think perhaps that's part of the explanation. I don't know, but I would guess that maybe has something to do with it.
And there was also a fear of invasion, and for the first time, almost civilians were also in danger during war.
Oh, indeed. I mean, the first trenches weren't dug in France or in Flanders. The first trenches were dug in southern England for fear of invasion. And there were civilian casualties right from the early days of the war, whether they were from shells fired from German naval ships, as happened up on the northeast coast, Scarborough, Whitby, Hartlepool, both Hartlepools, in December 1914. Subsequently, Zeppelins, big airships flying over the east coast cities, dropping bombs. And then, of course, by 1917, you get full-scale bombing raids, large numbers of German bombers coming over and dropping death out of the sky. So there were civilian casualties right throughout the war, of course, on a much smaller scale than in the the army, but there were civilian casualties right from the start. And I think that it was understood very early on that it was a war that would involve everybody.
Mm. Now, you mentioned casualties, but some of the casualties from the front line, be it by mustard gas or be it by shell fragments or bullets, but there was an awful lot of sight loss and blindness caused by the war.
There was a tremendous amount of loss of eyes or damage to the eyes during the First World War. All sorts of areas of medicine made huge advances during this war. Of course, it would have been better had there not been a war. I'm not saying that. But there were, of necessity, huge strides made in medicine during the First World War. Take another example, not blindness, but amputation. If you look at the number of men who returned without legs or arms after the First World War, you will find the proportion goes down as the war goes on. The reason for that is that in the early stages of the war, it wasn't realised how much damage could be done by the contamination of the filth of the trenches. Once that was realised and new forms of antiseptic were developed, and the need for what was called wound excision, which was to cut away any flesh that might be slightly contaminated, so you stopped gangrene setting in, then the number of amputations fell. Similar advances happened in plastic surgery and the reconstruction of faces, and there were many advances, I'm not familiar with the details, in the care of the eyes, the care and treatment of the eyes, but very large numbers of men were blinded. And one of the most moving images, of course, of the war is those poor blinded men after a gas attack, each man in single file with his hand on the shoulder of the man in front because they couldn't see where they were going.
Mm.
And, you know, these are the early days when you see at St. Dunstan's, which is still commemorated now on Armistice Sunday in November, you still see these old veterans from there. Not First World War veterans, obviously, but you still see that there is a great ongoing duty of care to men who have had their eyesight damaged or destroyed in war.
St. Dunstan's, of course, still provide that support, but under the new name of Blind Veterans UK. Now, that image you mentioned of the soldiers standing in single file is on the wall of the RNIB Talking Book Studios for the simple reason that those soldiers returning from the front with no sight and perhaps losing some sensitivity in their fingertips, so Braille was really hard to learn, that's where the Talking Book service started.
I didn't know that.
Mm.
Well, thank you for telling
that
me.
That was the impetus of the Talking Book
service. I don't
know about
you, but I think that the whole point of life, what a ridiculous thing to say, but it's certainly what's always got me out of bed in the morning is curiosity, and I now feel I've learned something today, which is a lot better than it's been so far today.
Uncle Charlie must have made it clear when he signed up that his mother, Florina, was a widow, for the printed Sir with which the form begins has been scored out and replaced with a handwritten Madam. The impersonal tone resumes with the printed sentence, "It is my painful duty to inform you that a report has this day been received from the War Office notifying the death of..." And here the Colonel in charge of Medical Corps Administration at Aldershot has inserted into the blank spaces Uncle Charlie's name, rank and number, adding, "Number 34 Field Ambulance of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force," in the space left blank for his unit. The cause of death was, and here an entire line of the form is left empty, which the Colonel has made no attempt to fill, just writing the single unilluminating word, "wounds."
A clip from Jeremy Paxman's Great Britain's Great War, which, of course, is available from RNIB Talking Books. And Jeremy, thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
Thank you for having me.